From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a year from the midterm elections, why it's hard to read too much into the state of races like the one in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District.
Yeah, with Paul Ryan, it's like whatever President Trump may or may not be doing, will that play to him? Will that benefit, you know, the Democrats? And of course, we just don't know.
Later, we'll look back to the presidential election 29 years ago and how it helped bring about a conclusion to the Cold War.
And when Siona Benjamin tells people about herself, they don't know quite what to make of a Jewish person from India.
Because of that uniqueness, there's always either a sense of surprise or sometimes even disbelief, like, you know, how come there are Jews over all the way over there? And I said, well, that's where it kind of all started. And so I have to remind them about it. You know, then they're like, oh, yes, yes, of course, you know, like they kind of remember.
Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We're 1 year away from midterm elections in this country. Here in Wisconsin, voters will decide whether Scott Walker gets another term as governor, whether Tammy Baldwin continues in the U.S. Senate, and for voters in the 1st Congressional District, whether Paul Ryan will stay in Congress.
That race is being watched around the country, largely because Ryan is a national figure in his role as Speaker of the House. His complicated relationship with President Donald Trump has led some to wonder whether he could be vulnerable to a challenge, either from within his own party or from a Democrat. Well, one of the Democrats running for the nomination to face Ryan has gotten a lot of national attention himself.
Randy Bryce has made waves on social media and in political circles around the country for his approach to the race. Journalist Annette Witheridge spent some time this fall following Bryce's nascent campaign, and she reports on it in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. We reached her on the line from New York. Welcome to the show.
Having me.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of his campaign, remind us how Randy Bryce managed to have such a rapid rise into the national spotlight.
In modern terms, he went viral. He linked up with two video makers, or a video maker and a campaign manager, who specialize in pretty, you know, sort of good, slick videos. And he basically brought along his family. All his family were involved, and it was like, you know, his own struggles. You know, he's an iron worker, he's a veteran, his mother has you know, health issues, his father has health issues. He also had cancer in his 20s and worries about health care for his son. And I think he basically, you know, it kind of caught the imagination.
He kind of ticks a lot of boxes as far as symbolism goes.
He definitely ticks a lot of boxes. And I think many, many people can relate. I mean, so often, you know, nowadays our politicians, our lawmakers are, you know, they're policy wonks. They basically have, you know, they've straight from university. They go to work in D.C. or they work in sort of Senate in various states. And here is somebody who every day, you know, has to think about his wages, putting food on the table, paying for insurance. You know, he's every man.
He's every man, but he's also every man who has never won who's never successfully contested an election.
That is the other thing. Now, I mean, he's done two sort of fairly major ones in the state, plus the school board. And this is something his opponents have been very quick to point out. Now, I'm told that he's learning on the job. And I don't know that perhaps when he first started talking about running in April, but quite, you know, most certainly did not expect the campaign to take off as quickly as it did.
There must be concerns, though, about peaking 16 months before an election.
I think there probably are. I mean, he has to be consistent. One of the people I spoke to, Barry Burden, who's a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin. Now, his thought is that, you know, it's great to do a very slick campaign video. However, in the rough and tumble, I think were the words he used, of the campaign, there's a lot of sort of gotcha moments, ambush moments. You can't control those things. You know, you have to be up to speed on everything to expect questions about North Korea, to expect a wide variety of things that, you know, you, so you have to know so much about everything. Now, obviously, I think this is going to be a race that is obviously being watched, you know, certainly by the whole of America, to see, you know, what happens. It's technically, it's a very important election. So the world, or the world, America will be watching Wisconsin's first district.
This is, of course, not the first time that Paul Ryan has faced opposition. And even in the last couple of election cycles, the people he has faced have gotten some degree of media attention. What do you see as different about this race potentially? Because obviously we're still a year out. What might be potentially different about this race than those that have come before it?
I think Donald Trump has a lot to answer for on this one. Various people said to me, it's an outsider moment. It just goes to show that somebody who's had no political experience, who's never run for public office, and that's not Randy, obviously, never run for public office, can actually become the president of the United States. So suddenly the world is saying, okay, who's like the third most important, Republican? And obviously that, you know, is Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan has one of his jobs is to hold the party together, be the face of the Republican Party. So suddenly everybody's watching. And I think that, you know, previous candidates perhaps were running against him, probably knowing they didn't have the resources. I mean, Paul Ryan has a pretty big war chest. I think he's got, you know, $10 to $11 million dollars in it. And normally, you know, the other people, his opponents, have sadly very little. And I think on this one is that, you know, obviously with Randy Bryce, he's building up, you know, quite considerable campaign funds.
Right, he seems to be tapping into an ability to raise money from sources that that others have not.
He's also going for the, you know, the $10. It's the Bernie Sanders routine of, like, small donations. You know, you don't have to, you know, give $2,000 or $200. It can be $20 or buy a T-shirt or, you know, I think, you know, or a ticket to a barbecue. That's where the money tends to be coming in. Now, obviously, because of the way the video has gone, the campaign video has gone viral, you're also getting a lot of money from, say, Hollywood, from New York, D.C. Money's coming from outside the district. That's probably the first thing that's happening.
The other interesting thing that's at play here is Paul Ryan's complicated relationship both with President Trump and with his constituents.
Yes, I mean, I first went to do a story on Paul Ryan when he was running for vice president, and I went to Janesville, where nobody really had a bad word against him at that point. You know, people were like, "Wow, you know, our representative could be the vice president." So he was a bit of a rock star, you know, young, sort of like, you know, dynamic. And of course, that's changed. I mean, it's changed. Really, I think since he became Speaker, but most certainly since, you know, his support of Donald Trump.
What is the experience like tagging along with Randy Bryce as he kind of figures out what the campaign trail is all about?
I mean, it was interesting because, you know, I first met him. Hilariously, we were trying to find a bar to go to, and I was with his campaign manager, David Keith, and every bar we tried, and when I say every, it was two. One had closed down some years before, and the other one wasn't open on Mondays. So we were all laughing, and it was kind of a lovely introduction to him because, you know, it was like, you know, we can't find anywhere to go, and eventually we walked into a bar and sat down, and it was interesting to just see how many people came up to him. And it was literally, you know, hey, you know, Randy, this is great, you know, high-fiving him. Now, I mean, he's almost like, I think, quite nervous. That sounds crazy to say this. So many politicians and so many would-be politicians are very, very charismatic, you know, take over a room immediately and, you know, tell you what you want to hear. He's not like that. There's a certain sort of like, he listens, he's quite quiet. He's very attentive. He thinks about his answers before he gives them. And then, you know, afterwards we had a lovely old chat. This was our initial interview. And we had a good old chat about books. And I mentioned a book I'd just been reading that had fascinated me. And he's like, wow, okay. And you see he's listening and, you know, then he made notes in his phone. And, you know, and it's like, I mean, he's certainly, he's certainly recognized instantly nowadays in Wisconsin, and as we know as well, around the country now, too.
We, of course, are having this conversation as though he is going to square off against Paul Ryan. He actually faces a primary challenger who, you know, has pointed to some potential flaws in his campaign.
I mean, Kathy Myers, I mean, I feel kind of sorry for her. Like, you know, she's almost been referred to as the forgotten candidate. I also interviewed her, and, you know, I mean, their stances on the issues are actually fairly similar. I mean, I'd probably say they were sort of progressive. They favor similar things. She's already, you know, won elections. And yet, you know, it's his campaign video that you know, has taken off. Now, I think on certain issues like the Enbridge pipeline, she has a stance on that. And I'm not sure we, you know, Randy, when I spoke to him last, was still taking the, you know, look and see. I mean, obviously, he favors jobs. That's the one thing that, you know, he's, you know, he's get jobs back to Wisconsin. But then there are environmental thoughts on the pipeline, that sort of thing. And I think Kathy is, you know, she's also, she's working, she's going part-time. But she doesn't have the weight behind her. But, as you say, she's not a shoo-in. I mean, he's not a shoo-in. As the Democrat candidate, and you know, there's a primary in August that will actually, you know, hopefully, you know, sort of, well, hopefully, that will decide one way or another who is the candidate.
Yeah, I guess in this era of contested elections, hopefully, maybe the best we can hope for. Finally, you know, you mentioned the idea the jobs issue being kind of his bread and butter, and at least one political observer points out that the Foxconn project kind of puts him between a rock and a hard place.
That is a very difficult one because, you know, initially he would go, I would think probably, you know, some time ago, he'd have gone, wow, great. I mean, the other thing is Foxconn is, if you like, Paul Ryan's baby as well. And depending on what happens with Foxconn. Now, at the moment, and I think, you know, sort of Randy says this, it's like, you know, there's you know, incentives, there's you know, tax packages. And he needs to know, we all need to know, is where those jobs are going. Will they actually be snapped up mainly by people in Illinois, or will it be the people of Wisconsin? Also versus the environmental impacts again. And it is, how do you get jobs back and protect the environment and make sure that, you know, the sort of the tax benefits don't harm the people of Wisconsin?
It is a pretty thorny issue for, I think, a lot of politicians on both sides, actually.
Yes, I think it probably is. And it's because it could be, you know, it's something that could totally change the face of Wisconsin. You know, unemployment rates and things like that. I think the worry is it was being, or the thought was that Randy said was it was being pushed through too quickly. That you know, it's like, hang on a minute, let's see what's really happening here.
And again, we're having this conversation, and as we speak, it is just about a year from the election, and a lot can change in a year.
Well, as I always say, you know, a week is a long time in politics, and I think in 2017. Sometimes an hour can be a long time in politics. So anything can happen. And it is that thought that, you know, sort of like, you know, there's so much of the rough and tumble of the campaign trail that could happen. You know, and things like, you know, with Paul Ryan, it's like, you know, whatever President Trump may or may not be doing, will that play to him? Will that benefit, you know, the Democrats? And of course, we just don't know.
Exactly. Well, Annette Witheridge, yeah. It is a great read. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Reporter Annette Witheridge's feature on First District Congressional candidate Randy Brice is in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to it from WUWM.com.
We'll turn from the election a year from now to an election from 29 years ago when Lake Effect returns. We'll explore the Bush administration and the end of the Cold War in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today is the first Tuesday in November, which is typically the fall election day in this country. A year ago, Donald Trump was elected president, and a year from today, people will go to the polls in Wisconsin to vote in the gubernatorial, congressional, Senate, and state legislative races.
29 years ago, this was the day that the Reagan era started to reach its end as George H.W. Bush was elected president. The 4 years Bush was in office were themselves an end of an era. It was in that eventful term that the Cold War essentially came to its conclusion with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Presidential scholar Jeffrey Engel examines the end of the Cold War through the lens of the Bush White House in a new book called When the World Seemed New. And we reached Engel at his office in Texas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to talk to you.
So I want to start this in a strange place. I mean, I had a chance to speak with John Meacham when his biography of George H.W. Bush came out a year ago. And I remember talking with him about the idea that the years George H.W. Bush was in office may have been the most eventful 4 years of a single term in history, or certainly among them. Is that a conclusion you would draw as well?
Oh, most definitely. In fact, I'd go a little bit further to say that George Bush's 4 years in office presented as complex and as numerous and as difficult a series of challenges on the international stage as arguably faced by any president in American history over the course of their entire administration. I think the only rival, in fact, is really Franklin Roosevelt, and of course he was in office 3 times as long. So it really is remarkable how many things occurred at the same time that would have normally it captured the attention of an entire administration's 4 years, but instead they just happened like dominoes in this one.
You write in a number of places that George H.W. Bush was arguably the most qualified person ever to be elected president. Can you talk about his life experience before the vice presidency, certainly, that most contributed to his ability to manage this unprecedented time in world history?
Yeah, well, he was, in fact, I think, the person with the best resume before becoming president that's ever held the office. If nothing else, he's certainly within the top two or three. He was, at different times in his career, obviously he was a businessman, and then a very successful one, actually. And then he was a congressperson from Texas, and then he was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then head of the Republican National Committee, then de facto U.S. ambassador to China. He was essentially the ambassador, but we didn't formally have diplomatic relations at that time. And then, of course, he was head of the Central Intelligence Agency. So it really is a remarkable series of achievements and accomplishments and goals, which all, for the most part, wind up focusing in the international realm. And when he became president, that was really the place that everybody understood his particular expertise was as a diplomat, as an international actor. When he was vice president, he did a lot of work both in front of the camera and also behind the scenes for the Reagan administration, essentially smoothing out things internationally with a whole cadre of leaders around the world who he either already knew or who would know when he was president. So it really was a remarkable experience he was able to draw on.
So really, the word I used in that previous question, manage, is really an appropriate one in this case. He seems to have had a really distinct managerial leadership style.
He really did. One of the things that we're discovering now that the archives are really open for this period, frankly, is just how dangerous and tumultuous the entire period was. I mean, the end of the Cold War can be understood in many ways as the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And we know, going back through history, that there are basically no examples of a major empire collapsing without an ensuing great power war. And certainly no other examples involving nuclear weapons in the mix. So one of the things that Bush was able to do was to draw upon that international experience and all those international contacts in order to essentially, while craziness and chaos was breaking out around the world, to pick up the phone and to call foreign leaders and to have private, long, deep conversations, sometimes well into the night, sometimes for several hours, essentially calming international tensions, working out international agreements ahead of time, keeping essentially the machinery of the international system going at a time when it could very well have seized up.
Right. One of the key areas, there are really two events in this period in particular that maybe people are only appreciating with the passage of time, and I wanted to talk with you about both of them. There is much made these days about the sort of quietness with which, maybe there's not much made, maybe it's just because I've read your book, there's much made, the quietness with which President Bush responded to the fall of the Berlin Wall, that is his reluctance to dance on it, if you will. Why was that such an important aspect of his response?
This is really a remarkable story because it tells us a lot about him and also about the times. So to set the stage here, the fall of the Berlin Wall happens in November of 1989, which is about 4 years into Mikhail Gorbachev's experiment of reforming the Soviet Union, really changing the Soviet Union in what can only be described as a revolution. Now, needless to say, Gorbachev as a revolutionary had a lot of enemies. He had a lot of enemies within his own government. In fact, we would see only about a year and a half later, they would come to launch a coup against him, essentially conservative communists, if you will, who didn't like the democratic direction he was taking the country. And Bush was keenly aware that Gorbachev was essentially on shaky political ground the entire time he was in office, and also that Gorbachev's enemies had a lot of allies, if you will, around the Eastern Bloc. So when the Berlin Wall fell, when Eastern Germany seemed to be on the verge of collapse, when the empire of Soviets seemed to be on the verge of collapse, Bush consciously said, I'm going to not say anything. Essentially, others around the country asked for him as the president to lead a victory parade or to give a victory speech. And he wisely said, you know, if I say anything dramatic, if I crow, if I beat our chest, that's going to add ammunition to the enemies of Gorbachev, who are already upset and thinking about a coup. So rather than essentially exacerbate tensions and make things more difficult for our allies, Gorbachev in particular, I'm just going to keep quiet. Keep quiet, even though critics are going to assail me and my poll numbers are going to drop. I know that the future of the world, frankly, is more important than my poll numbers.
I was just going to say, there was a political cost to him for doing this.
Dramatically. I mean, he was always a person we should remember who had come up through the Republican Party. He was a very establishment candidate. And as a consequence, you know, he had a reputation for being someone who did not speak his own mind in many ways. He was honestly referred to as a wimp on the presidential campaign trail. And therefore, when he didn't stand up at these moments, it seemed to reinforce the image that this was a man with no principles. This was a man with no backbone. His poll numbers dropped after Tiananmen Square when he acted quietly, after Berlin Wall when he acted quietly. Basically, his poll numbers only went up in foreign policy when he stood up and conducted the leadership of the Gulf War, you know, essentially made a strong military stand in the Persian Gulf. Most other times, he was perfectly willing, not happy, but willing to accept political barbs and accept political consequences for what he believed was the necessity of quiet diplomacy.
The other landmark event I was hoping you would address that you just referenced it is the Tiananmen Square uprising, which was, first of all, an event that caught many in American politics by surprise. What was the balancing act he had to orchestrate when it came to China?
Well, one of the things that's really critical about Bush is not only did he know China, having been there and believed that he understood China, he also understood China's democratic movement in many ways as a natural progression from China's engagement with the world. He had been there in the early 70s when China was essentially just reengaging the world. He had known Deng Xiaoping when he was first setting up China's leader, who was just first setting up the economic reconstruction of the country, if you will. And consequently, Bush believed that the more China was engaged in the world, the more it would become naturally prosperous and critically democratic. And he saw the Tiananmen Square uprising in many ways as a validation of this idea that, look, China's been engaged in the world for over a decade now, and now its people are really clamoring for democracy. Therefore, of course, when that democracy movement was crushed brutally by Deng Xiaoping's regime in June of 1989, Bush essentially had one of two options. He could do what his critics suggested, which was isolate the Chinese, punish the Chinese, cut off all trade with the Chinese. And Bush chose the opposite course, which was to essentially sanction the Chinese, yes, but really to leave the door open for them to remain engaged in the international system, because he firmly believed that democracy that had flourished at Tiananmen would basically flourish again if only given the opportunity to have the sunlight and the fertilizer, if you will, of international contacts. And he really tried to take a long-term approach to where he thought China would go.
Right. He was looking at it from an incremental standpoint.
Yes, with a very long time frame. He recognized that having been in China, he recognized that the history of the Communist Party, you know, went back generations, and it had transformed dramatically over those generations. And consequently, he expected that, at the very least, after Tiananmen Square, when he tried to have quiet diplomacy and keep relations open, he still recognized and discussed with his advisors, it's going to be 5, 10, maybe 15 years before we're able to talk normally again with the Chinese. But we need to start now so we can get to that place in 15 years.
It is interesting to read about that time and consider that time in the history of U.S.-China relations and consider what the current president, as we're having this conversation, is about to go to China and is taking a decidedly different approach.
Yeah, it's really hard to find two people whose actions in the White House are more different than George Bush, 41, and Donald Trump, where Bush was quiet, was confident, was really experienced. Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, is none of those things. And we can really see that in the way that he's conducting not only his China diplomacy, I'm talking about Trump, but also his diplomacy in East Asia more broadly, which is done largely by tweet and by bluster, two things that George Bush, even if he had had the opportunity to tweet, I'm sure he would not have in office because he recognized the power and the effect of not only his own words, but of the mistaken word. He was always worried about saying the wrong thing inadvertently and having markets crash or having an international incident be occurred. The idea that he would send out his thoughts spontaneously without thinking about them just honestly never occurred to Bush.
That was partly what his diary was for, but even from reading pieces of his diary, those words are pretty considered as well.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time in his diary, and it's really a wonderful thing that we have a diary from the president. He may actually be the last president that we know of to leave a diary. It's too dangerous in many ways these days.
Yeah.
He really spent a lot of time thinking through issues, working through issues, and frankly, doing a fair amount of venting to his diary. So, he was willing to criticize his opponents and to question his allies in his diary, knowing that he didn't want to do that publicly because of the political consequences or the international consequences. So he could refer to his critics in his diary, for example, those who said that the United States should pull back internationally after the Cold War, as stupid peaceniks and as beatniks and as lots of 60s terms, actually, and as isolationists, something which he would never have done in public because that would have been the story, not the issue. He wanted to keep focused on the issue.
It's hard to consider the words peaceniks and beatniks without imagining his, political opponents wearing berets and smoking little cigarettes.
Exactly. Well, it really does tell us a lot about who Bush is. This was a very conservative man in the sense that he was a traditional business person. He was a traditional Republican, frankly, of the kind that doesn't exist anymore. He believed in free trade. He believed in international trade. He believed in internationalism. Believed in a strong civil rights regime, at least as far as the federal government is concerned. He believed, frankly, in immigration. He believed, essentially, I like to say, that both George H.W. Bush and to a large extent Ronald Reagan, too, essentially would have no place in today's Republican Party because they're just simply way too centrist for today's discussions.
One of the ways you were able to break new ground with this book was to get access to previously classified or sealed or little known documents. What were the kinds of sources that you were able to tap into which had theretofore been out of sight?
Well, these were all documents largely in the Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas, and they were documents that we knew were there, but we were not allowed to have access to. Essentially, the way our declassification system works is that even after 25, 30 years, in order to get a document released, a national security document I'm referring to, something from the State Department or the CIA or the Defense Department, you essentially need to ask for it, and then it needs to be approved by that agency that you can have that document. Well, you can imagine this can be a very long, arduous process. So We've been working on a massive declassification project at the Bush Library that's going into its 10th year now, essentially trying to ask for whatever we can get after we identify that there are documents that we want, and then honestly just crossing our fingers and hoping that we get them. And by applying for literally tens upon tens of thousands, we have been able to get a fair number out there. And what's really wonderful about that is that these are all then available to everyone in the general public and to future historians. Anybody with a driver's license can go look at those documents tomorrow if they wish.
If I read it correctly someplace, did I see that the number of FOIA requests you had for just those documents dwarfed the number of all the other FOIA requests at other presidential libraries in the country?
Yes, at other presidential libraries. And this is one of those great statistics and one of those great facts that one of the archivists in Washington told me at one point that our project has more documents under review and requested than all the other presidential libraries combined. And it's one of those statistics that you just decide not to verify. It sounds nice, but more importantly, the point that I think he was trying to make is that this really is the largest ongoing project of its time, in terms of getting as much as possible out of one particular resource.
What were the greatest surprises for you, things that you might have thought you knew about that period that you understand differently today?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the greatest surprise to me is how dangerous the situation was. I think I really can't stress that enough, that there are numerous moments when we look back on the end of the Cold War, we generally think of it as a celebratory time, as a time of democracy flourishing, as communism collapsing, and really an optimistic time. We now know that there are any number of scenarios, any number of false moves that could have sent things spiraling out of control. So one of the things that was really amazing to me and that came to be impressed by over and over was how Bush and other leaders, but Bush especially, worked very hard to keep calm and to keep others calm, to keep the international system calm, while still recognizing something that's really, really important, which is that at the end of the day, the President of the United States or the Premier of the Soviet Union actually has less control when a crowd goes up to a police station, say in Leipzig or in Tiananmen Square, than the average soldier on the street. You know, one 17-year-old soldier who gets nervous and fires his weapon can start a cascading international incident no matter what the president says. So it really drove home to me the idea that when we have an international crisis, honestly, such as we are seeing today in many parts of the world, that the more a president can decrease tensions as a general proposition, the safer we all are. Because in a time of heightened tensions, frankly, even the people who think they're in charge don't really have a lot of control. The person in the crowd who can pick up a rock or the young recruit who can fire his gun because he's scared has actually more control in that moment to cause chaos than even the most powerful people in the world.
Well, Jeff Engel, it's really a fascinating read, and I thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to folks from Wisconsin. I miss it up there.
Jeffrey Engel's new book is called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Engel did his graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, and today he's founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Texas.
Coming up next, an artist with a background that surprises many people. We'll meet Siona Benjamin when Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Painter Siona Benjamin grew up in Bombay, India, in a community of Jews that had been in India for thousands of years. Since then, she's lived in the United States for over 30 years and has spent time in Israel. Home and identity have become central themes of her work.
Her vibrant paintings fuse Indian mythology, biblical stories, pop culture, current events, and Near Eastern, South Asian, and other influences. She brings a feminist and modern perspective to traditional stories and has received two Fulbright scholarships in the past decade.
Benjamin's currently based near New York City, but she'll speak in Milwaukee tonight at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Lake Effect Mayan Silver reached her ahead of that talk to learn more about her unique upbringing.
When I look back and when I think back to my childhood, it was extremely unique. I didn't think much about it then because I was, you know, in the middle of it and I didn't think it to be anything actually. But now, many years later, when I came to live in the United States, I've been here for 30 years. And, you know, it has made such an effect on my life. India is very unique that way. It has many different communities. And here I was, a Jew raised in a Hindu-Muslim India. I went to Catholic middle school and Zoroastrian or Parsi high school. And India has many different religions like that. And it is a very tolerant country. It's a very accepting country. And it prides itself in its diversity. It's one of the oldest countries in the world that has that much amount of diversity and acceptance. And Jews never suffered any anti-Semitism. That's the only country in the world, only place in the world where Jews have never suffered any anti-Semitism. Well, a little bit here and there in the hands of Portuguese when they came in, or, you know, but overall, India itself prides itself in its diversity.
Well, and you said in the documentary, you said you were not Indian enough for the Indians and not Jewish enough for the European Jews, because you've moved from India to the United States and you've lived in Israel. Can you tell me why you didn't? I mean, we've talked a little bit about your feelings in India. Why didn't you feel Jewish enough for the European Jews?
There's a uniqueness about, oh, you're a Jew from India, you know, and how is that possible? You know, like, people are less aware of Jews being in other parts of the world other than, you know, Jews coming from the Holocaust or people, Jews coming from Europe especially. So because of that uniqueness, there's always either a sense of surprise or sometimes even disbelief, like, you know, how come there are Jews over all the way over there? And I said, well, that's where it kind of all started. And so I have to remind them about it. And you know, then they're like, oh, yes, of course. You know, like, they kind of remember that, you know, people have to be sort of reminded about that.
So it's you said in one of your pieces that you don't get Yiddish jokes, and you've been living in the U.S. for a while. So I was wondering if you picked up on any Yiddish at this point.
Of course I have. you know, I definitely have. You know, I use words like schlep and, you know, all these kind of Yiddish words I didn't even know were Yiddish, you know. And I was told, yeah, that's what it is. You know, it was just a joke in the painting. Like, people would ask me, you know, you didn't grow up with matzo ball soup? And I'm like, no, not really. I grew up with Indian Jewish coconut curries.
Nice.
And you know, they said, "Well, that's so strange. You didn't grow up with." But I said, "What's you know, regular for you is not regular for people coming from other parts of the world." And I really, really believe that till we as a human race understand that, there will be misunderstandings and intolerance and racism and wars, because you have to understand that difference that we share, and instead of finding it weird and strange, one should celebrate it.
Yeah.
Till we understand that really well, there will always be these problems that we are facing right now, I feel. And so part of my work is kind of about addressing these issues and not shaking my finger and scolding people about it, but just with humor pointing it out and letting them laugh with me about it instead of, you know, being upset with them. Because I think there is misconceptions everywhere in the world. Like, I could go to India and they would have misconceptions about Americans that would, you know, annoy me. So it's not just one kind of person what I'm trying to talk to. It's just all of us. We have to understand and celebrate these differences better.
There's kind of this feeling in your work of trying to encompass kind of all humanity into the subjects at one time. Why is it important for you to fuse imagery from different religious and cultural traditions?
As a contemporary artist, I'm influenced by the different art and mythological traditions that I have lived in and I have studied. But I'm not painting any one god. I'm not painting any idol. I just paint figurative art, and it happens to be telling the story. But I do take references of certain mythologies that I have lived in or I have studied.
Well, one of the things in your painting is that you have women with blue skin. And can you tell me how that represents being a Jewish woman of color?
Sure. Well, when I was doing my, started creating these works in the mid-90s, I started making works which is more nostalgic, about who I am, like questioning my identity, who I am as an Indian Jew, what is my place in society in America now. I started asking all these questions to myself, and I started making this series of works called Finding Home. And when I started making the characters, like the characters in a play, so to speak, who are acting, dancing out parts of this story that I want to enact, I started thinking, okay, what shade of brown should I paint these characters, which would be appropriate? And so I came up to the conclusion that none of the browns or skin color would be sufficient. So I thought about the blue color of the sky and the ocean and how that stretches all over the world. And it makes it sort of boundaryless. It makes it, that I can belong everywhere and nowhere at the same time. At the same time, I come from India, and I was influenced by, the Indian mythology, Hindu, Muslim, whatever it is. And, some of the Indian gods are painted a dark blue or a purple. Krishna was a very dark-skinned god, and so he was almost like a purple-blue. So, there's these influences of the mythology of generally India too, but my blue is this light sky blue. And so I feel like I can belong everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
Well, and you did a photography project with subjects from the people in the community that you grew up in Mumbai. And I wanted to ask you about one of the men that was one of the subjects. He was actually blind, and he was able to translate Hebrew into Marathi, which is the dialect that is spoken there, right?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about him and how you conceptualized that piece?
Sure. So I got my first Fulbright is when I went to India, and I photographed and videoed all these amazing, some of the 70 or so people of the remaining 4,000 Jews there for the few months that I was there for my Fulbright. And Samson was one of the people that I interviewed and photographed. I wanted to go back and look at these faces in India. They're like maps to me. I wanted to remind myself, what do these faces look like? How do they speak? I remember them from my childhood, but I wanted to go and have a record of them in some way. And when I took photographs of them, I'm not a photographer, so I thought, either I paint him or paint all these characters over again on a canvas, or then I decided to use the photographs. But I did photo collages on the computer where I took the original photographs and I combined them in many different ways on the computer with the help of my computer assistant. And then I sent them off to be printed on large pieces of paper, of watercolor/photographic paper. And when they came back, then I painted on the surface on top of this photograph. So it's a 3 by 3 feet large piece of paper where this photo collage montage was printed. And then I painted with paints on top of that. I wanted to tell the story of about the person, but not the whole life story of the person. I wanted to tell certain aspects about that person whom I interviewed, certain highlights about who they were and what stood out for me about them in this piece. And I did a series of 40 photo collage paintings out of the 70 people that I had interviewed. And also there's a video collage that is available that you can see on the internet. But then this American filmmaker came and took me back to India, and we met some of the people, the characters that I had interviewed, and he included them in the film to show the process of what I had done, say, in this Fulbright.
And in that painting, you had some artistic choices of using large Marathi writing, but it was Hebrew words translation, yeah. And then it went down in size like a doctor's office.
Yeah, because this gentleman was blind, and he had turned blind over the years, but he, instead of, like, he didn't, you know, waste his life, he decided to translate and transliterate, the Hebrew prayers for the community, for those people who couldn't speak Hebrew properly. Those who could, it's fine, but those who didn't, he transliterated the Hebrew words into Marathi so they could follow along and read it. And he published many books with the help of the Jewish Agency, you know, in Mumbai. And so he knew the prayers by heart, and so he could just dictate them. And it was very amazing to kind of meet him. It was kind of like, this was his work, and his life had changed because of his blindness, but he didn't let that come in the way. And I found that extremely amazing to meet this gentleman and his family.
You have an entire series that you, is it completed or is it still open, called Finding Home?
Well, Finding Home kind of will always continue, but it's sort of branched off. So imagine Finding Home as like the main tree trunk, and the branches are like Farishte, which are women in the Torah that I choose to explore. So I'm studying Midrash with a rabbi in New York City, on and off. I study with him and with Rabbi Burton Visotsky at Jewish Theological Seminary. And if at all I have a project, I always consult with him. Or if I want to study Midrash or the myth, I use these mythologies as jumping boards to be able to kind of translate, into more current socio-political issues or what's happening today. So,
can you explain what a midrash is?
Yeah, a midrash is rabbinical interpretations of the Torah. So, through the ages, rabbis and scholars have taken text and have debated and translated and the meanings of all of the stories and the mythologies. I'm doing a visual midrash where I'm taking some of these mythologies, but it's nothing religious about it. It just, for me, it is just a story. And that story gives me a jumping board to be able to talk about, to connect that story to today's socio-political situations or what's happening today. So I can feel my art is more relevant. I'm talking about things that are happening today to me and what's happening in the news, and be able to connect that. So the old and the new gets connected.
Well, speaking of the old and the new, where you are today, what do you think of as home today?
After much searching and finding, calling my series of the original series of works Finding Home, which then became many other series, Improvisation and Farishte and all the other works and the installations I've done, I've come to a conclusion that initial searching for home is kind of like redundant, and it's not necessary, or it's not there. For me, I feel there is no real home in that way, because I asked, is India home? Is Israel home? Is America home? Well, they kind of all are, and none of them are. It's like, I feel I came to a conclusion that home is where I pitch my tent and what I make of it. And because I feel like we all have become world citizens more than ever. And this division or, nationalism of, making divisions I'm not saying that we should dissolve countries, but I'm just saying that there should be a better understanding, I feel, of we being world citizens, instead of, saying I am better than you, or I can't let you in, or, you're not welcome here, or whatever. I think it should be more of an understanding of world citizenry and globalization in that way. So I'm searching about that through my work. I'm trying to find answers for that. And I feel like it's a continuing journey, for me to be able to search for that fantasy home, which I realized later on is really not there.
Author and photographer Teju Cole, he's of Nigerian descent, but living in New York City. And he said that he's most at home wherever there's good Wi-Fi. And or in a cosmopolitan setting, is what he said. Not yes, to me, but in an interview that I heard.
Yes, absolutely. I feel, I mean, I have found the, I mean, I feel like my home is in and near New York. I feel exactly what this author has said. I feel like I want to be in a cosmopolitan area. I want to be, you know, I want to be inspired by good art, by good music, by accessibility to culture. Even when I travel all over the world, I always, you know, go to the museums or I go to listen to concerts because I feel it really inspires me and it puts me in a place where I can see the relevance of my work to what's happening also. So I really like to also be where there's good Wi-Fi.
Well, Siona Benjamin, thank you so much for speaking to us on Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Artist Siona Benjamin will speak tonight at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The talk is sponsored by UWM's Stahl Center for Jewish Studies. There's more information about the talk and the screening of the documentary about Benjamin, Blue Like Me, at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie Norris.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect from 89.7, listener-supported WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.